Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Sioux City Council is holding its primary election on October 10th. 9 candidates will be running for 3 open seats on the council. The candidates are incumbents Alex Waters, Dan Moore, and Pete Gretkin. The other candidates are Brett Watchhorn, Doug Waples, Nick Davidson, Jake Jungers, John Olson, and Dennis Quinn. Today we'll hear from 3 of those candidates. First, we hear from Alex Waters. Waters is an advisor to first-year students at Morningside College. He's known around Siouxland for his rebounding from a severe spinal injury years ago that left him in a wheelchair. Waters graduated from Morningside College with a bachelor's degree and later received a master's degree in negotiation and dispute resolution from Creighton University. He's running for a full term this year after being chosen last year to fill Keith Raddick's seat on the council. Waters says this first year on the council has really been a whirlwind of activity.
Holding a full-time job and then taking on these different challenges and responsibilities is something that I'm very passionate about. But I mean, when you're talking, we get our agendas Thursday afternoon and you have to be prepared by Monday at 4 p.m. I mean, you're talking hundreds of pages of material to look over, not to mention debriefing or talking with staff to get their perspective and why they're putting this forward or why they think it's important. Because for me, I think it's important to do your homework. I think it's important to be really well-read and well-versed on these topics because at the end of the day, I have to be able to defend my position. And so a whirlwind is probably how I would describe it, trying to get up to speed with all of those issues facing our city and things that are exciting about our city, but how we can help continue to grow and move forward in a positive direction. So it's been an incredible experience, but definitely a whirlwind.
I noticed, you know, watching the proceedings, I've been there a few times, but mostly, you know, I've been there online, but watching the proceedings and hearing people talk, especially about issues about growth, when we talk about putting in a new hotel, we talk about changing the way things look downtown. I see often you speak up in favor of growth, and not everyone agrees on that.
Yes, to say it nicely, not everyone always agrees. For me, I mean, speaking frankly, what I think a lot about is we need to have a vision for what the future of our city looks like and what we're going to do. One of the big things that I'm going to talk about a lot on the campaign trail as I look forward is how are we going to attract and retain a new workforce, like a new group of people, or how are we going to convince these students at Morningside, Briarcliff, Western Iowa Tech, all of these great educational institutions that we have, how are we going to convince them to stay here and want to grow here? And have their family or expand our tax base so we have more money to do things so I don't have to raise taxes. Things like that, I think we need to be focused on where are we growing and how can we improve our areas. I always laugh. I think that the hotel decision was a little contentious because, quite frankly, I think it was a lack of information. I think that people don't understand how interconnected a lot of the different projects for the reinvestment district are and how it's going to help our whole city just grow and really instill a lot of energy in different neighborhoods, which I think is important. I mean, you don't build a hotel for the people that are here, right? They stay in their home. You build it for the people that are coming to our convention center or visiting our restaurants or our theaters or our performances or Tyson for concerts. I mean, that's why you want to have good quality hotels throughout our city. And that's why I'm really supportive of that growth in our downtown and other neighborhoods as well, because I'm thinking of the future, the vision that we want to have for our community.
You know, in the last, in the period where they appointed you to the council because Keith Raddick went to the County Board of Supervisors, one of the people that's running again, Doug Waples, said he did not think it was right to just appoint someone to the council. Now, he's running again. He'll be in the primary with you. What do you think about that? Do you think it would be better to have elections for these things?
As far as elections for special appointments, it depends on the length of time, right? I mean, that's what I think every instance is. I think every instance needs to be looked at and said, okay, do we need to have an election? How much time is remaining on that term? Now, I would point out, I like Doug. Doug is someone that I've talked with a lot about some issues. He's very passionate about our city, but he ran for the appointment too, so I don't know what that says. But when you're talking about a 7-8 month term, and spending $15,000 to hold an election, that's not something that I view as fiscally responsible, right? I think that if you elected four people up there, you know, if four of those people were elected at large, I think that we need to be able to trust them to make that decision in the short term. Now, if you're talking a couple years or a few years, like if someone just started their term and there's going to be 3 years left, maybe that's when it makes more sense to go to an election and say, no, we want to let the people decide this again, because there is so much time. When you're talking 8 months of an appointment, I don't think that it's financially or fiscally responsible to spend that kind of money for that process. And so that's why, not because I won or anything like that, but because I think that when it's such a short time frame, I wouldn't want to spend that kind of taxpayer dollars on a process like that.
Well, and of course, you know, not a year later, you have to run yourself. So it's not like you're going to be, as you say, being on here for years without an election.
Correct. I think that's exactly right. I mean, yeah, it was just recently appointed and now we'll be up for election. And so now the people will decide. I mean, it was short enough. And now we're going to be spending that money for a primary and a general election anyway. Why burden the taxpayers with more elections with really low turnout, especially for the same cost to taxpayers? So for me, I think that the appointment process worked well in this instance.
So recently, the city council passed this ruling that there'll be an hour of free parking in the parking ramps. And there was a lot of discussion about this. This went on for, actually, this has been talked about for months, pretty much, before this has become actually valid just today, Monday, the 19th. Correct. Now, why do you think that's such a contentious issue?
It's tough to say, right, of why certain people are fired up about it or passionate about it. And I think there are a lot of different angles that we have to think about. And I think that that's where sometimes why it took a little longer to get to this consensus and just see, hey, let's try something. Because there are so many angles to think about, right? Because we want to think about our parking committee that we have in place that's going to analyze the revenue generated as well as the cost going out to maintain, things like that. So we have to keep that in mind. We also have to think of organizations like Downtown Partners that presented their proposals because they're working with businesses that are downtown. Then you have to think about our responsibility to taxpayers and saying, okay, well, we have these businesses. We want to promote growth. We want to promote more shopping. More people spending their money in our downtown and visiting our downtown. So we have to think of all those things and take in all that consideration before making a judgment. And I mean, I trust in what the parking committee came up with. If they think that's the best idea moving forward, they listen to all of that. And I'm a big fan of trusting our committees and really putting faith behind them and saying, yeah, if that's what your recommendation is, let's try that. It's just a 6-month trial. And then I think we're going to look at the demographics. We're going to look at the numbers and really analyze them. We're not going to necessarily be able to tell everything, but I think we can see how many people utilize that, what type of revenue was lost, but also talk to business owners. Was anything gained? Did they hear anything from their customers that they were happy that when they're downtown, they can just stop in, park in a parking ramp for an hour, run in, run out, and do their business, and not have to really get out their wallet or, you know, get out and pay that nominal fee. And so I think that it's something that I'm looking forward to following because, as you said earlier, I'm a big fan of downtown growth and businesses. And I think we need to instill that that there are tons of parking options downtown. We're just trying to make it more accessible during the day as well for that first hour free. So that's what we're going to try now, and we'll analyze it in 6 months.
That was Alex Waters, who was chosen to fill Raddick's seat on the Sioux City Council last year. He's running for a full term along with several other candidates. One of those candidates is Doug Waples. Waples was one of the Siouxlanders who put their name forward to fill Raddick's seat. Waples had wanted an election to fill that seat. I talked with him about that and other issues that he says he'd like to work on. I know that you were one of the people that put your name forward last fall when one of the council members went over to the Board of Supervisors. You didn't get that particular seat, and I think you were somewhat concerned about the person being chosen rather than voted for.
It was an elected position, and I still feel that it should have been put up to the citizens.
Yeah, some people were saying that would be expensive to have that election.
Yeah, but I had the signatures to require the election, and I ended up not turning them in. But, you know, the thing was, I took a lot of flack for going to have everybody have to pay the $30,000, which, the city would have been responsible for. But I didn't put the council in that position. You know, the person that left put the council in that position. He was already elected to a spot. Then he chose to run for county commissioner. He was elected, and I feel it still should have went to an election.
Well, now the person who has that spot is one of the people running in a real election, Alex Waters. There are three spots open.
Yes.
What are some of the things you'd like to do if you were on the city council?
I think we're behind on the infrastructure, on the streets, the curbs, the gutters. Everybody wants to, we've got to have new business. We got to have progress. Yes, we've got to retain the people that graduate from college and school here in town in Sioux City. But at the end of the day, if they've grown up in Sioux City and have dodged potholes with their cars, they're not going to want to move back here. We've got to make the streets better. And we've got to improve working on our sewers and waters so we don't have trucks falling through streets. We don't have houses sinking from sinkholes. And when we repair these items, we've got to get them done in a timely fashion. The reason I'm running for council, I got interested in October 24th of 2013 when they could not complete the Hamilton Bridge project on time. And the journal that was writing the article about it called the engineer that was in charge of the project and asked him why it was behind. They could not answer that question. And that's when I decided to get interested in city government. There's something got to be wrong when you're overseeing a project and you don't know why it's behind.
What do you think about some of the issues that have been facing the council this year, the new hotels in town, the parking ramps, the sort of the new development to bring people and business to town? What's your feeling on those issues? What would you have said about those?
I would not have voted for the hotel the way it's configured right now.
I know the mayor had issues with it.
Yeah, and I think now a whole nother situation has come into light with the fact that the hotel down there now is for sale. And Dick Salem was at the council meeting, which I was at that night, and had a lot of good ideas on different ways to not build it in the parking lot at the convention center. It's going to make it very hard for people to use the convention center, I feel, the way they've got the hotel set up at this point.
What are some other things you'd like to see happen in Sioux City? I mean, for instance, they're going to have this, starting this week, that they've begun the free hour of parking in the ramps. They're trying to figure out different ways to get people interested in downtown. We've got sort of the events downtown where people can come and have lunch. Do you think those are a good idea?
I think it's a good idea. It's not going to hurt anything to try the free hour parking, Whether I'd have voted for it or not, I don't know. But it's not going to be a big expense to the taxpayer. I mean, when you spend money, you've got to make sure it's going to work when you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to have something designed and then get the report and don't either follow through with it or don't take the suggestions.
I think one of the things about being on the council are so many issues, small issues, big issues, so much paperwork. When you see the amount of paperwork that goes with each issue, no matter how small, it's a fairly big time commitment, isn't it?
Yes, I feel that it is a big time commitment. When I was working a full-time job, there's no possible way I could have done it. It's just like the Morningside Street and parking issue that come up a week ago. That should have never ever went to the council. The thing they were going to do was going to kill the people's retail walk-in trade. I'm not in favor of backing into a parking place on a busy street. Maybe it works somewhere. I can't see, when they have a drugstore there that the older residents occupy or visit, there was no way that was going to work. And everybody that designed that street should have known that long before then. That, in my opinion, that should have never, ever been taken to the council. Every Thursday, like at 4:30, you can get on the website, and it shows you everything that's going to be talked about on the council. And if you don't read that every week, things go through there that never, ever make the paper. I mean, you have to look at that deal every week. You know, I've, in the last 3 or 4 years, I've probably either watched on TV or been to the council, probably haven't missed 5% of them, you know. And you, like I said, if there's an item you're interested in, you really got to watch what's on the agenda each week, because it flies through very quickly. But you have a chance to speak. You can speak under citizens' concerns, or you can speak on the item as it's coming up. But numerous times I was the only citizen at the meeting. And I was just there to watch.
Yeah, I think, and they've had meetings specifically for allowing citizens to come up and give their opinions. And both, I think, with the city council and the board of supervisors have seen very few people ever show up.
That's correct. Correct. That you know, it's surprising. A lot of people complain about what's going on, you know, either with a comment in the paper or on the radio. And but I don't see a lot of people trying to do anything about it.
Well, I think you probably would like to do something.
I think I could help. I mean, I think I can make a difference.
That was City Council candidate Doug Waples. Waples is a retired businessman who attended Western Iowa Tech Community College back in its early days. Candidate Brett Watchhorn also attended Western Iowa Tech as well as Briarcliff University, earning a bachelor's degree in psychology. He now works with Walgreens downtown. Watchhorn became known around town when he spoke out in favor of more days, not fewer, to set off fireworks in the midst of a chorus of disapproval by many after the 4th of July this year. Watchhorn says he had wanted to have a referendum on the issue.
I deferred to actually let the city vote on that rather than the city council, just to see what, you know, that 80,000 people would prefer rather than those four. Because I feel like the people who actually address the council directly and know them aren't always a marked piece of the population.
And I believe the city said they didn't have a mechanism to do that.
They I can't remember the word they used either, but if I'm right, it was referendum. And the thing about referendums is you can make new ones. I don't understand why they didn't even consider that, and I'd like to know why. They never really gave a direct answer of that.
You were one of the few people there who was speaking out in favor of more freedom to set off fireworks, and I believe that you were sitting next to a lady with a bag full of fireworks that had landed on her lawn on the 4th of July week, and she was very upset.
Yes, and I was very polite to her, and she was very polite to me, which I was very kind. I was very happy about, considering I spoke before her. I thought for sure she was going to give me a dirty look or something, but she was very nice. I understand that aspect, but the thing is, I feel like instead of taking that bag and taking it to the city council, why couldn't she take that to her neighbors that actually set off those fireworks? What was stopping her from having that discussion rather than coming to put it in public in the forum? That was my only dissenter there. I don't knock anyone for coming and voicing their opinion, obviously, but that was my thought, and that's always been my thought. Anybody who has problems with their neighbors setting off fireworks, why can't you talk to them? Why? There's a communication issue throughout society now, honestly, that people don't.
It's easier to call the city and say, I have my neighbor has a nuisance problem, can you come look at it, than it is to go to the neighbor and talk to them about it.
Exactly. And I don't understand that. I don't like my neighbors, but I'm more than willing to go speak to them if I need to. And I don't see why anybody else can't do that. You live next to these people. What's the harm?
What are some other issues that are of interest to you? I know that you were concerned about a parking issue.
I'm not all that concerned about the parking issue. I just mentioned that because I don't like the reverse parking that they put in downtown. And they proposed it for here in Morningside, which was immediately shot down because the business owners and the people who live in Morningside were able to voice their opinion and tell the council that this is ridiculous. This is the way it's been for so long. You may see a safety issue, and this outside firm may see a safety issue, but it's a non-issue here in this community. I don't see how reversing into a space is any less dangerous than
yeah, and you weren't the only parking. One who had concerns. They were just talking about that this week as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Also, what do you think about all the new hotels downtown, about the trying to develop downtown into a place where people would want to come?
I love the idea. I really do. But I believe we burnt that idea to the ground when we decided to only allow the Hard Rock to build. My opinion on that whole situation was to let all three casinos build. Competition breeds profit. With Hard Rock the way it is now, they have no competition. So they can charge whatever they want and no one can bat an eye. I worked at Hard Rock for a little while, and from what I saw on the inside, that was my major issue. The fact that they realized they had no competition. And then now they're proposed to take over the Tyson, and I as much as I would prefer an outside firm governing the Tyson and the Orpheum, I want anyone but the Hard Rock, because that's literally just adding to their monopoly. And what incentive do they have to lower ticket prices if they own everything? And as for the hotels, I don't get it. I don't. I believe it's a waste of money and space. The Warrior, I think it was the, no, that was the casino. The building that they're refurbishing to make into a hotel, that I'm okay with. That is cool. I think that needed to be done many years ago. There's also a hotel downtown that they really need to do that to. I believe it's up for sale.
That has been sold several times.
And once again, it's up for sale. Where they're placing the one that I'm really, that Mayor Scott, like I said, dissented against is right across the street from the Promenade Theater. Where there is literally their only parking. I don't understand what makes that and a good idea, as well as we don't have the attractions in Sioux City to facilitate these hotels. I mean, yay, we have a place to stay, but what is there to do? I have a 5-year-old, and honestly, I take him out of town to do anything because there's nothing for people in this town under the age of 18 to truly do as activities, and that makes me sick. What draw do we have to bring in people to bring in profit to these hotels? It doesn't make sense to me. But the development is always a good idea. I just wish that we could do more. And something different. Obviously, like I said, some kind of entertainment, anything. I don't know what the city is capable of there. My original suggestion got shot down really quickly by one of my supporters. Was to build a water park somewhere here in town just to have something. But after talking with a friend of mine and whatnot, I realized that the city supporting that is one thing. Funding it is a completely different idea. So supporting it, yes. Funding it, not so much. I'm not okay with that, obviously.
Now, you're the demographic they would really like to bring more of into Sioux City. You're a young professional. They want people here that are young and have ideas and want to do things, but I think that this goes along with what you were saying before. We need to have the jobs for those people to make it happen.
Indeed. The packing plant that's opening up here soon, I understand, but we've lost a packing plant. So I don't at the same time, I don't understand how they're expecting to bring in these old businesses that have literally already failed here. That doesn't make sense to me at all. And yes, you're right. The one other person that I've spoken to that's running for city council, his name is Jake Jungers. He is 28 years old, a year younger than me. I was so happy to see somebody else in my age range even trying to get into this into the spectrum. But yeah, bringing in young professionals. I mean, we had that ability when Gateway was here, when we had MCI, when we had many things that actually brought in younger, talented people rather than Workaday. Not that Workaday people isn't a good thing, it's just it doesn't add to the population that we need, that we need to continue growing the city. Sioux Falls' population has expanded greatly over the past 10 years, where we have basically stagnated. And I'd like to look into really why that is.
That was Brett Watchhorn. He is one of 9 candidates running for 3 seats on the Sioux City Council. Next week on The Exchange, we'll talk with the remaining 6 candidates running in that primary. It's set for October 10th. The top 6 winners in the primary will run in the general election on November 7th. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. While many of us think of the South when the specter of lynching and racial violence comes up, in the years following the First World War, there were several race riots in the Midwest. In the red summer of 1919, a violence exploded on the streets of Omaha, where many immigrants and African Americans lived on the south side of town. At that time, Omaha was run largely by one man, Tom Dennison, who was the political boss that controlled patronage and many other issues as well. Journalist and author Ted Wheeler spent several years writing a novel about this period called The Kings of Broken Things. Wheeler says he first heard the story of the lynching when he was in grade school in Lincoln, and it really stuck with him over the years.
I think mostly it was just so shocking to see it. Like, for one, it was this famous photo that was on the front page of the World Herald in 1919, but it showed the burnt body of Will Brown, who had just been lynched. And I don't know, like 30, 40 people that were surrounding him that had kind of celebrated that this happened. So one, just being 10 years old and seeing a burned corpse, it was just a really shocking image to be exposed to. But also the fact that it happened in Omaha. And I grew up in Lincoln, so, you know, an hour away, but still Nebraska. So I guess I'd never really thought, you know, things like that happened in Nebraska or locally. So it's just kind of shocking to be exposed to that and to start thinking about the world and the place where I lived as, you know, this kind of deeper place where bad things also happened.
And as a journalist, you worked a lot in the courthouse.
Right, yeah. So for the last 10 years, I've covered a beat at the Douglas County Courthouse and also the federal courthouse here in Omaha. So for every afternoon, every weekday, I'd be at the courthouse and kind of walking in the footsteps of where a lot of that stuff happened.
Can you talk a little bit about what happened during the riot? A lot of us have heard about it, but maybe people don't really know the whole story.
Right. So I think there is a lot of political intrigue behind it, which is the book deals with a lot of that, too. But Tom Dennison, who was the political boss of Omaha at the time for 30 some years, really. But he had his mayor, who was Cowboy Jim Dahlman was his name. But he was elected 8 times to office. And at this point in 1918, he had been elected 7 times in a row. But they lost this time to a reform slate. Ed Smith was elected mayor. So over the next year, the Dennison machine, was on this campaign to more or less discredit Ed Smith by committing all of these crimes, to just kind of show that Ed Smith didn't have control of the city in any way. And over that summer, I think there were like around 30 rapes of white women, mostly done by men who worked for the machine, who were in blackface. And then the newspaper, the Omaha Bee, was more aligned with the Dennison machine. They would sensationalize this as the era of yellow journalism. So, you know, just kind of built this up more or less to discredit the new regime. But by September of 1919, when the riot occurred, you know, all these things had been building up so much. It was the year after World War I ended, where a lot of soldiers had come back. There were major labor struggles that year as well. Along with racial struggles, where a lot of African Americans were coming up from the South to fill those jobs when people had left for the war effort. So I think all these things just kind of combined that month into building this major event that happened at the courthouse.
And basically, there was a big mob, and there was a man that had been accused of raping a white woman, a black man accused of raping a white woman. They went to the courthouse, demanded that they bring him out.
Correct, yeah. So Will Brown was his name. He had almost been lynched previously the Friday of this weekend, where the police had arrested him. He'd been identified as, you know, the accused in this rape and assault. And they had tried to lynch him at the house of the alleged victim. And the police had to, like, run in. It was this big scene where they charged him with a car and pulled him out, like, threw him in the back of a truck and sped him off down to the courthouse for his own safety. But 2 days later, a riot broke out on a Sunday afternoon, mostly led by a bunch of boys from South Omaha and around the area who had come up demanding that the police hand over Will Brown. But there was also the Exarban Carnival was going on that week in Omaha, so there were tens of thousands of visitors in the city. And more or less, you know, that carnival atmosphere broke out around the lynching and the riot, where you had 10 to 16,000 people around the courthouse in downtown Omaha, nearly burned the courthouse down. Ed Smith, the new mayor, was actually hung. He was hung up by a traffic signal and had to be cut down and whisked away, and he was nearly killed. So it was just kind of a giant, crazy event to happen in what is now mostly a pretty sleepy downtown.
And Tom Dennison, who I think I told you was my mother's great uncle, and I've heard all these wonderful stories. He was a great man. He did wonderful things. He ran Omaha. And mm-hmm. so hearing the other side of it, and I've heard whispers about him before, hearing the other side of it is kind of enlightening. I think it's kind of a thing a family doesn't like to talk about.
Yeah, I'd imagine. And I mean, in researching it too, I think Tom Dennison did do a lot of good things for this city, just in that era of bossism, as it's known. You know, he ran the public utilities, like basically, like if you needed a job, you would go to him and he'd help you out. And I think when he died, I'd read a story, like he didn't have any money left, or they went to like his bank accounts to and expected to find all these jewels and all this cash. And he had like $24 in a watch because he'd given away so much more of it. Like if anyone ever needed help, like it was known that he would help you out no matter the situation. That duality of it is just so interesting too, that I think he did a lot of good things, but it's still organized crime at the base of that. And a lot of bad things happened around it.
And he takes an interest in one of the main characters in this, Jake, who comes from a small town or a farm, I believe it is, in Nebraska. And the other boy is an immigrant from post-war, World War I Europe. And both of these boys play a part in these events and what goes on. But Jake, he really takes an interest in Jake, and he gives him a job. He gets better jobs, and all these things happen. He becomes very much a part of the Dennison machine.
Yeah, for a while, he's kind of Tom Dennison's protege almost, where he's brought in very close. Which I'd based the character of Jake Strauss somewhat on stories from my own family history, where my family is more around Niobrara, Nebraska, where they settled after they came from Germany.
In the aftermath of all this, where Jake, he goes west with, is it Evie?
I say Evie, yeah.
Evie. Jake goes west with Evie. They keep going. They have a whole nother life. It never really leaves their mind, their whole lives.
Right. And I think just doing that in the story, besides just kind of feeling realistic and offering, you know, a sense of closure to the book, but I wanted to think a lot, because Will Brown isn't a super major character in the novel itself. Like, he doesn't get that much page time. But I wanted to have this sense of these characters get to move on with their lives and other characters don't. That Will Brown was murdered at the courthouse. And even though, like Jake specifically, who can double crosses people he shouldn't in the novel and does all these bad things, is involved in organized crime. But more or less, like when he wants to get out, he can just leave town and do that and start a new life. So in setting up that comparison was a big thing.
There's that picture, that famous picture of this poor man after he was hung, after they had hanged him, being burnt, and all these mm-hmm. men of the town who perpetrated this behind him, some of them are smiling.
Yeah.
It's such a haunting image. A lot of people don't know that's not from like the Deep South. That's from Omaha.
Right. A lot of the time there were 30 some riots that were somewhat similar to this around the country in the time, most of which were in industrialized northern cities. So it is, I think that is, you know, just something, at least growing up in Nebraska, like, we did have a lot of education about civil rights and these things, but it was generally kind of couched in the terms that it was a regional southern problem. And again, you know, I think that's why it's so interesting and so vital to talk about it, because it totally wasn't. I mean, it was much worse in the Deep South and much more common, but these things did happen up in the North as well.
Now, you worked on this book for several years.
Yeah, for about 7 years it took me to write.
It really seems to have hit home with a lot of people.
Yeah, the response has been really great so far. I mean, just doing the events, they've been well attended, and usually we've been just chatting with people for a half an hour after every event, just because people are really into it and want to learn more about it.
I must say, it must have really sort of, you know, touched you as well, like emotionally writing this and getting into all this history.
Yeah, it did. I think it was, a lot of times it was really difficult, especially I think towards the end of it, writing the riot scenes and around the lynching, just emotionally to do the process of doing that. I think it took me a few months where I wasn't necessarily, didn't have writer's block necessarily, but I just couldn't do it. Like, it was bad, I guess, more or less. Like, but I went to Tel Aviv one summer around that time, and with my wife on business, and just spent a lot of time in parks writing on a legal pad. And I don't know, that having that physical distance, like just being away from Omaha, being away from home, made it a lot easier, and it just started coming out. So most of those scenes I wrote outside of the house, just going to a park or even just sitting out on the porch. It was a lot easier emotionally to do that without, you know, being across the hallway from my 2-year-old daughter's room, or I don't know, those notions of kind of shame, or just that it was so dark. It was a difficult process to get out.
Oh, you're used to writing a lot. You're a journalist. Journalists, all of us do a lot of writing. But I imagine it's a different sort of process to be writing a novel and working on this for several years.
Yeah, I think that was a lot of it too. Just, this is my first novel, so learning how to do that and like how to do it well. So I wrote 3 drafts of this book with different strategies, different perspectives, and even different characters in them until I could find the right mix. But I think I'd often heard that, like that most people, you don't publish your first novel that you write, or, you know, even maybe the second one, the third novel you write, you kind of learn what to do. So even though it was a hard process over several years doing that and having to start over a couple times, I think I always took comfort in that, that even though I was still writing the first novel, like, you know, I got the bad one out of the way, like the one that you kind of just waste. So hopefully this will be the good one. This is the keeper.
So are you looking ahead to another book now?
Yeah, this summer I actually just finished a first draft on a new novel, which is set in Omaha and Chicago in 2008, mostly around the Safe Haven adoption crisis, which occurred in Nebraska in 2008.
I think it's really great that you're writing about this area. There's actually so much history and so much that has happened and is still happening here. It's not just a flyover place.
Yeah, I know. I feel kind of lucky for that. And I've always been a history buff, so knowing about these things and then seeing that nobody has written a book about it, or that there really hasn't been much treatment and besides straight history, I always get excited about that, because I feel like, one, that I can do it then, that I'm not stepping on anyone's toes, but two, that it is, you know, my home too. And I feel like these are compelling stories that, you know, have national and international interest beyond just the regional.
That was journalist and author Ted Wheeler. He's the author of the book, The Kings of Broken Things, set in the summer of 1919 in Omaha, when a lynching and race riot became national news. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The 2017 National Endowment for the Arts National Heritage Fellowship concert last Friday featured Onawa resident Dwight Lamb. The 83-year-old is a Danish button accordionist and Missouri-style fiddler. He's one of 9 recipients of the fellowships, the highest honor given by the federal government in folk and traditional arts. We spoke with Dwight Lamb this summer about his music and the cultural legacy he's trying to pass down to future generations. Dwight Lamb says he started playing the accordion at a very young age.
My grandpa sold his farm, my mom's father, and he came and lived with my parents, and I was 12. And of course, he brought his accordion and his fiddle with him, and I don't know, I fell in love with that accordion music, so that's how I started. He was always around. Dad worked during the day, but Grandpa was always home. But he helped me get going. And then shortly thereafter, we moved back over to Moorhead, back where my folks all were raised and where my grandpa's farm was. So it was kind of home to them. And then that's where I really got started. Because I was still listening to the same old radio fiddler I had for many years. And shortly after that, all the live talent went off the airwaves. And I just tuned in one morning. There was nobody there, only just the record. So then I was kind of on my own for a few years till I graduated from high school and got my own car. And then I decided to find him. And I looked him up. And I worked with him as long as he lived. I had to spend a couple of years in the military over in France. But I left my reel-to-reel recorder on. My folks would either go over to his place or he'd come over home and they'd make me some tapes and send over to me. So I kind of kept up on my music even while I was over there.
Now, his music was a particular kind of fiddle music, right?
Anymore, they call it the Missouri Valley style, because it seemed like up and down that Missouri River Valley, a certain type of music was played there, and it's similar to what the Canadians play, is a more notey hornpipe, harder style of music, and that's what I got. And later on, I used to travel down into Missouri, became good friends with Cyril Stennett down there. He was a left-handed fiddler like I am, and he was really a champion fiddler.
Now, I know that you also play the accordion, and it was your grandfather that taught you to play the accordion, as you said.
Yeah.
This is Danish music.
It is. It was from his father. He came over here in 1893 the first time, and he stayed a year or two and kind of made a few friends and acquaintances, and he went back and he got married and had a couple of kids even before he came back over the last time. And
it's Danish folk music. I hear that finally over in Denmark, they're big fans of yours and they're teaching the folk music again.
A friend of mine in Missouri had been making fiddle records for Rounder Records, and he said, I was talking to Mark Wilson, the guy that does all the recording for Rounder, and he said he'd like to make a CD of you. And I said, well, tell him to call me. But it wasn't long he did. And so we got together and I made two over the years, and on both records, just for a little change of pace, I put a couple of Danish accordion pieces on there.
Do you go around and play at the folk music festivals at all?
Yeah, I've been around. Mostly, till the last few years, it was all fiddle stuff, but I've taught out at it's called the Festival of American Fiddle Tunes out at Port Townsend, Washington. Three different years I played out there, and one year the National Bluegrass Association invited me to play at the Cedars 11 on State Park down near Nashville. They call it Breaking Up Winter, and they play in the middle of winter, and they had me come down and play. And I played at the International Accordion Festival down in San Antonio. That was one. And even down there at Breaking Up Winter, I played quite a little accordion there too, so I always take both.
Do you see young people at these concerts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of them. Folk music is really kind of coming back.
Why do you think that is?
Over in Denmark, they kind of, my grandpa's, great-grandpa's tunes kind of got laid aside for a few years, and I think that's happened here. I've seen the music scene change here in America several times growing up. You know, fads take over for a while and change. And I think a lot of the younger people, even the kids, college kids, are really interested in some of these real old pieces, you know. They've been digging back in the old record books and notes trying to find them. So I'm encouraged that it's going to stick around.
What does this fellowship mean to you in terms of your playing and your art?
I don't know how to explain that. It's just, it's really an honor that I was awarded this. I've always tried to live up to the fact that I've tried to teach the old time stuff.
Well, could you play a little for us?
I didn't bring away my accordion, but I could do that.
That'd be great.
A fellow over in Denmark gave me this. We played that big tuner festival, Tuner in Denmark. It's been a good one. I could probably play one of my grandpa's little Danish polkas.
Lovely, you know, that smaller accordion. I'm used to seeing those great big accordions. Yeah. You know, it does sound very different.
Yeah. There's a lot of music in these little accordions, no bigger than they are. You have 10 buttons. This is what they call a diatonic accordion. Because when you push in on a button, it's one note, and when you pull out, it's different. So this is one Christian calls a small waltz. No, this song. Those are two old tunes that he brought over with him in 1893, I know.
Well, Dwight Lamb, thanks so much for coming in.
You bet.
Dwight Lamb intends to return to Denmark in the near future. He plays the fiddle as well as the accordion. Here's a bit of Dwight playing a song called Jake's Best Reel.